Well, hello everyone. Today we have Cal Newport, and we're going to be talking about his new book, How to Become a High School Superstar. And I'm really excited because, as you know, I talk about Cal on my blog pretty much every second blog post, and we share a lot of the same readers, and we cover a lot of the same ideas, particularly this sort of quest to go beyond the self-help cliches and figure out what does it really take to be successful and also live successfully so you really enjoy your life and get what you want out of it. So maybe, Cal, you can tell a little bit about what your book is and why it matters, why it's different.
Yeah, hi, Scott. So the pitch for the book is that it's supposed to be about high school students, American high school students, who were able to do well in the college admissions process while at the same time living non-stressful, sort of uncluttered, interesting lives. So it's sort of defies the cliches that if you want to succeed in competitive college admissions, you have to be all stressed out. But what I think is relevant to sort of what you've been talking about in your blog, what I've been talking about, is that I actually pitched the book as being general, right? Not just for high school or college or graduate school, but just in general about this idea that we talk about, that you can be successful in parts of your lives without it being a stressful life. So the publisher restricted it eventually to be just about high school students, which it applies very well. But I think for the purpose of our conversation, the ideas I think are relevant to anyone who's wondering what makes someone sort of an interesting, impressive person, and how much of that is tied to lots and lots of hard work, and how much of that's tied to something else. So those are the sort of ideas it explores, and maybe we can explore here.
Yeah, definitely. And I when you talked about the title of the book, and I know even your blog, like the formal title of your blog is Study Hack, but really it's more life hacks. It's more about the broader pursuit. I know a lot of your readers aren't even students anymore, aren't really interested in the studying game, just as mine are. And it's really about these broader questions about, you know, some of the issues that you talk about in your blog, which I've also mentioned on mine, are like passion. Should you be pursuing your passions or should you be building them? That's an interesting question that often isn't asked. Things like, you know, what's important in being impressive? Is it doing lots of hard work and lots of discipline, or is it doing something unusual? And how do you get to that point? So I think that you display a level of deep thinking that is sort of unusual in the self-help circles, particularly the blogging self-help circles, which are more likely to quote Oprah and copies of The Secret than actually really delve into what's the philosophy of this, what's the logic, what's the reasoning behind it, and why should it work. So I really appreciated that. But one of the things you talk about in your book, which maybe you can explain a little bit more to me and to the readers, is sort of this superstar effect, which is that people who are able to get in through these very difficult college admission processes, and obviously it applies to a lot of other people, they do very well, but they also do very well often without the grind. And even in some ways, they're actually fairly average or maybe even a little bit below average in terms of just their sheer credentials, like just their sheer grade point average or their sheer amount of extracurricular activities they're doing. But somehow they get able to overcome that and really excel in their field, get into these really elite universities, even though they're maybe less impressive on just sort of from a numerical standpoint. So maybe you can explain how they're able to do that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So something that was shared among a lot of these students I found, I call them relaxed superstars in the book, to use some terminology from admissions, but these students that had the non-stressful lives but did well tended to have this trait that they did not do very much in terms of diversity of pursuits, diversity of accomplishments. But the very small number of things they did them really well. And as I dug into the science of that, there's actually three real reasons why this notion of doing very little, but doing what you do very well, is actually a sort of a profoundly smart strategy for being impressive in a way that's sustainable. The first reason actually goes back to an economics paper that was published in 1981 by an economist named Sherwin Rosen, where he was the first to identify this notion of the superstar effect. In essence, you can work through the sort of complicated mathematics that all adds up to a simple conclusion, which is if you're the very best at something, you get a sort of bonus of impressiveness. That is, you get a sort of disproportionate amount of rewards as compared to someone who is almost as good as you, but just not quite, right? So that really pushes you towards, well, try to pick one thing to be really good at so you get that bonus, whereas if you're just sort of kind of good at many things, you're not going to get it. Two other things I found is that there's this interesting effect out there called counter-signaling. And it's actually kind of counterintuitive, but it says that signaling lots of medium ability accomplishments, that is, say, lots of clubs at your high school, that medium ability, that is, you have to show up, but there's not a real high bar for entry, can actually make you seem less impressive than if you did less of those signals. That is, simply just taking clubs off your resume and adding nothing else can actually make you seem more impressive. And this actually goes to the way that our brains are wired, and you can see this in the laboratory. Then the third is this notion of the Matthew effect, which Dr. Gladwell pointed out in Outliers, but shows up a lot in Ambitions, which is this notion that once you become known for being really good at something, lots of these sort of free accomplishments come along, sort of interesting opportunities and bonus accomplishments that make you seem even more impressive, even though you didn't have to do much before. So this sort of this trifecta of reasons means that the students, people in general, that focus on one thing, do that one thing really well, sort of get this huge disproportionate sense of impressiveness around them as compared to people that are just doing lots of things, all sort of kind of well.
No, exactly. I think that you tie into a lot of the points that I've been recently talking on the blog. I wrote an article recently where I was arguing that discipline and being hardworking, which we often see to be as keys to success, I feel doesn't really apply so much to these highly competitive pursuits. And I use the example of someone I know who is about, I think she's about 13, and she's in competitive swimming, and she's swimming about like 6 or 7 hours a day. And this is like a teenage girl, or like not even a teenage girl. She's swimming about 6 or 7 hours a day, and she's still like just in the run of the mill for the millions of other people who are swimming there. And so if you want to get into this really elite class, which is what your book is essentially talking about, that using discipline, just thinking, you know, I'm going to just work really hard and it's all going to pay off in the end, while you need to work really hard, it's not the decisive factor. It's not what makes the difference. And you talk a lot about here with these relaxed superstars is that how they're able to be so impressive isn't because they're so disciplined, they're so hardworking, they're doing all these different things. It's because they found something that is perhaps very difficult for people to understand how they were able to do it. And they focused on that to a point where they become very impressive, even though it's more from perhaps the strategy or the direction or path they took than actually how much hard work they put into it. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how that essence of remarkableness and the replication effect.
Yeah, I think this is a crucial point because in a field that has a existing well-defined competitive structure, say competitive swimming, playing the violin, to name a couple examples, it is, as you state, very hard to become the best and to sort of reap these benefits. Another example of one of these fields would be becoming valedictorian, right? It's a field with a very well-defined competitive structure. So something I write about on the blog and in my book is the notion that these students and other people tend to find pursuits that don't have a well-defined competitive structure because the secret is these effects I talk about, the superstar effect, the counter-signaling, Matthew effect, they all still apply, even if the pursuit you went after doesn't have a really well-defined competitive structure. So, for example, one of the students I talked about in the book, and I wrote an article about him on Tim Ferriss's blog recently, was this guy named Michael Silverman, who became very good at sustainability projects. And over the years that he worked really disciplined and focused on just sustainability projects, he got better and better, and eventually ended up getting thousands of dollars in grant money to install solar panels on the roof of the maintenance shed of his high school in Arizona where he attended. Now, the point is, he's a disciplined guy, and he was a hardworking guy, and he was disciplined in the important sense that he didn't get distracted by other activities. But if he was trying to do competitive swimming, for example, that amount of work probably wouldn't have got him that far. But because this was a field without an undefined competitive structure, he was able to become sort of the best at what he did from among, you know, say, the applicants that his admissions officers were looking at. So he got all these effects, and he got even though working on these projects was his only extracurricular, and though his grades were fine, they weren't, you know, valedictorian status. So I think that is a crucial point, is that these effects hold, even if what you're doing doesn't have a well-defined competitive structure. So you should be really wary if your goal is to become valedictorian or, you know, the first violin player in your high school or whatever, because that's going to be a really hard path. If you're a sort of sustainability expert or an expert on human ears, like another student I talked about in my book, you get those same effects when things are a lot easier.
Definitely, definitely. And there's one idea which you actually wrote about a long time ago in your blog, but you've also written about in this book, which I think is really interesting because it really cuts at the core of, well, how do I know, like, as you said, well-defined competitive structure in swimming versus sustainability, where it's, like, really difficult to say, well, how is there a competitive structure there? But I think one of the things that you point out, which is really interesting, in this whole pursuit of not just impressiveness, but what does it take to become successful and to reap the rewards of that success, is the sort of effect that if someone can do something and you can't replicate in your mind how they would have been able to do that, it makes them very impressive. And I'll just give the example of, for example, saying, like, for me, I recently learned French, and I would say I have a decent to, like, not quite fluent, but a decent level in French. And I did that over the last, like, year. And, you know, I put a lot of hard work in there. There was I did a lot of, like, practice. I made myself go out and speak to people. There's a lot of hard work involved in that pursuit. But it's not particularly impressive. It's lots of people speak a second language. It's not that important. And I contrasted myself to someone like Benny Lewis, who he did something which was incredibly impressive, which he learned 8 languages, and he's doing a language in 3 months. Now, it's a difficult period, but part of the reason that he's so impressive is not just that, well, he's working very hard on it, but that I can't even imagine how someone would become fluent in 3 months. That defies my logic of what's possible. And this sort of, these people that do something which sort of defies expectations, defies the possibility of, well, what can I do? What is reasonable expectation? These are the people that are really impressive and really reap the rewards of their success. And you were talking about that even implies, even if what they did isn't actually that difficult, it's just very difficult to imagine how it was done. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how that plays in your book.
Yeah, it's a fascinating effect. I call it the failed simulation effect because that's what's happening. You're failing in your attempt to simulate in your mind how Benny Lewis learns 90 languages or whatever it is that he speaks, which is so crazy. It's an effect I noticed students were using, and I didn't know why. In my book, I actually get into the brain psychology of why actually this effect works, but that's not important now. What is important is that it does. You can't simulate in your mind how someone does something, and you get this big impressiveness bonus. And I think once you understand that idea, it really changes the way you think about different accomplishments and what makes someone impressive. So another example, like Benny Lewis, would be like Chris Grubeau or someone who does the Art of Nonconformity blog and has a new book coming out. At the core of his impressiveness is this notion that he's visiting, you know, all of the countries in the world and has already visited over 100 countries. And you hear that and you're like, well, I don't even know how you would do that. He's not rich. He's doing this, you know, on a small salary. You know, how does he do this? And if you actually get to know him and read his stuff, you see, oh, I see, there, you know, the sausage making details are sort of boring. It has to do with around the world tickets, frequent flyer miles, and visa procurement companies, and these sort of things. But when you first hear it, you know, it gives this effect of, like, I don't know how to get it. So it's an effect that I am fascinated in, and I think what makes it interesting is, by definition, you can't think up from scratch an idea that's going to cause this effect. So if you follow that logic, you're able to sit there from scratch and pick up an idea and say, oh, I could do this, and this would cause the failed simulation effect. Well, the fact that you were able to think it up means that it wouldn't cause the effect, right? It was something that you were able to imagine yourself doing, and you could assume other people then could imagine themselves doing it when it caused the effect. So there's this nice sort of catch-22 with it. And I think that the key to breaking out of that, and what's sort of interesting about this effect, is that you have to go join some community, get involved in some field, become an insider on something before you start noticing these opportunities. So, you know, start doing lots of traveling and get involved in the world of world travelers, and then all of a sudden the idea of how you would visit every country in the world might all of a sudden become practical to you, but not to an outsider. So, I mean, this is, to me, this stuff is fascinating, but my advice, especially to students, when they're like, well, what can I do that would generate this effect? I say, go join something. Go learn the world. Learn the inner workings. You know, meet people in the world. Learn stuff about this world that other people don't know. And only then should you start looking, you know, for these projects that could cause the effect.
I completely agree, and I think there's a few, like, examples, because as soon as you explain it like that, it's easy to pop out a lot of examples. It's one of those models that, at first it seems confusing, but as soon as someone explains it to you, it really pops out, like, wow, that actually works that way. And I want to just point to an example of a mutual friend of ours, Ben Kasnoka, as I think is a perfect example of that effect, because, and I've mentioned, like, in passing, to some people in conversation something about Ben. And people who don't know him, usually I summarize it as, yeah, well, this is a guy who he's a published author now, but he started his first company when he was 15. Or I guess he started his first company when he was 12 or 13. He started his second company, which is the Comcape, which is, I guess, still up and running, which I don't think he does too much work for now. He started when he was 15. And so the idea of starting, you know, a multi-million dollar software company when you're 15 is pretty impressive. When you say that to most people, they're like, wow, that's like really impressive. But I think part of it is that it sounds really impressive because I don't know anything about enterprise software. I don't know anything about that industry. I don't even know how one would go about setting it up. But if you look through, and I read his book, if you look through the story, the actual path that Ben took to reach this sort of failed simulation effect, is it was interesting. There's definitely a lot of hard work, but part of it was, well, he started this like very small company. I think it was Complain and Resolve, I think was what it was. And he did a very simple task when he was 12. It was just people who had complaints about something with their local government could, or with anything, could call, and he would find the appropriate person to direct their request to. So it was very simple. But this kind of got him started in that, the whole software on the web area. And then he worked a little bit further and made a few little starting things, and then networked with people and met with people in that industry who actually knew something. And I think these little baby steps, while you can't envision them in advance, really create this effect where at the end of the journey, after you've been walking it for a while, you have no idea where the person started or the path they took to get there. So it's very difficult for you to imagine it. And I'm even thinking of myself in a lesser extent, when I talk about, well, yeah, I run a website and, you know, I can make a few $1,000 a month and I have several thousand readers. And when I talk to people about this, the reason that I think it sounds more impressive than if you aren't in blogging or if you don't have a blog is because if you don't understand how it works, lots of people I know who are in this industry, that would just be sort of like, yeah, that makes sense. But for people who aren't in the industry, it sounds very odd because they can't imagine how, you know, some university student would be able to do that. And I think that, you know, the same applies to you and the same applies to a lot of other people, that if you get into these communities, if you get into these pursuits where you don't really know what the destination is going to be, you just want to immerse yourself into this kind of subculture that has rewards, but you become really familiar with them, then you can really start to excel in that area and do things that people outside of the subculture can't even comprehend how you're able to do it. And I think that's a real key to success.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And it brings up the related point. And I always get in trouble every time I say this, but in essence, the key to that sort of failed simulation effect style projects, one of the keys is that you have to sort of overcome our culture's obsession with passion. This notion of, like, I have to figure out what I'm passionate about, I have to do the personality test, reflect, sit under a tree, figure out this is what I want to do with my life, and then I'm going to go out there and do it. Because when you break down these stories, you look at Ben's story, for example, which I tell in my book, I have a whole chapter about him, because not only did he do Comcape, but I also talk about how he later wrote a book, and then later became an NPR commentator. I mean, he repeats this, yeah. He repeats this thing again and again. But yeah, same with you with the blog. I actually had a business in high school. It's probably why I got into Dartmouth, even though it took less time than it required than, you know, of course, the track team. So it wasn't exactly a major commitment. When you look at people that actually do this,
you see there's never this moment where they get this flash, like, you know, Scott wakes up one morning and says, oh my god, I am so passionate about, you know, blogging, about personal development, I have to go do that, I have to go start a blog. But I know that didn't happen with you, because there was an article about you all those years ago. Or Ben didn't wake up one morning, he's just like, you know, damn it, that I was meant to do enterprise software for government. You know, this is my meaning in the world. But it doesn't work that way. It works the way you said, which is people who have a bias towards doing things, they have a bias towards going to talks, meeting people. Something looks mildly interesting, they say, why don't I try it? Why don't I, if you look at Ben's story, it's like, why don't I try to build a website? And then he had a class project, and the class project, they said, well, why don't I build a website for complaining about, like, their Elysees in Candlestick Park? And after that, like, well, why don't, it's just this bias towards, like, why don't you just try this? And then see what opportunities that opens up, as you say, that lead step by step to these really impressive failed simulation effect accomplishments. But the point is that you're obsessed with this notion that I have to feel a pre-existing passion before I go after something. Here's what's going to happen. Years and years are going to pass, and when that doesn't happen, you're going to find yourself with nothing to show for it. So I think the way you describe it is exactly right, and in order to get people to start down that path, they need to be more comfortable with the idea that you will become passionate about something as you move down that path, as you become more accomplished, as you cause the failed simulation effect, as it becomes more fun to work with. It's not something you should be looking for up front. So I know I get in trouble when I'm saying, but you've been backing me up somewhat on this recently, so yeah. I have a...
No, definitely. I definitely back you up. Two points that I'd like to make, because this is often a confused thing, which comes up in your articles, which is not your fault at all. It's just because lots of readers, actually most readers, don't read anything at all. They just read the title and then they... reactive comments based on that. But a lot of people say, well, oh, Cal Newport thinks that, you know, I should just work at a job I hate and keep working at it until I eventually like it. And that's not what you're saying at all. It's saying that this approach to passion, that passion is incredibly important. It's just that the way about getting it is not to sit around staring at your navel. It's to actually do something and start doing something, even though you're just interested in it and it's not like your life calling. But when you start at it and you start working at it, you build this passion once you start reaping rewards in the field. And I think that's completely true, because anybody who's gone into anything that's difficult, like enterprise software, well, like who's passionate, whose passion for life from the get-go is enterprise software for government. But if you start working in the industry for a while, you start building a company, you know, a few years down the road, once you start seeing some success, it could very well be your passion, what really gets you up in the morning. So that's the first point, is that it's not saying that passion isn't important, it's saying that it's very important, it's just that the traditional theory about how people find it is wrong. And the other point that you bring up, which I think is very interesting as well, is you talk about, well, people need to not worry about their passions, and I think that sometimes focusing too much on what your initial interests are, or not so much your initial interests, but the most obvious things, that sometimes gets you caught in these areas of life which have these very defined competitive structures which are very hard to win at. So, for example, you might really like basketball. Well, basketball, the NBA, has one of the most well-defined competitive structures there is. You know, there's only a certain amount of people, a certain amount of college athletes that are going to be drafted each year. And if that's what you imagine your passion for life is, then you're going to have a hard time, even if you were with an insane amount of discipline, there's still an extremely high chance you're not going to be able to make it. But if you translate this other approach to saying something that I'm not going to be passionate about anything from the get-go, that's going to build, and you say, well, what am I interested in? What seems interesting to me? And you might say, well, like software, I find this type of software very interesting. And you start working in that, you start getting in the industry, and then you can really reap these advantages of a loosely defined competitive structure, of having this failed simulation effect where once you get into the community, once you get into the subculture, you can now do things that people outside the subculture can't replicate in their mind how you were able to do that. So yeah. I think that following your passion is important in the naive way that you need to be passionate about something. In the long term, you need to develop a passion, because that's what matters in life. You're going to be spending a lot of time working. It's important to be passionate about it. I don't follow the the brazen careerist idea that, you know, whatever, work, you're not going to be passionate about, don't worry about it. I really don't agree with that. But at the same time, you can't be naive about it and think that, well, taking a Myers-Briggs test is going to answer all of your questions.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There's actually, it turns out, a huge amount of research out there on the question of how young people in particular develop really deep interests. So in essence, you can think about it as research into how do young people get develop passions, right? For educational psychologists, this is an important subject. They've been studying it since the time of Dewey at the turn of the century. And they keep coming up with the same result, more or less, which can be summarized as you actually have to have lots of free time in your schedule. You have to use that time to expose yourself to lots of things that are potentially interesting. And you have to have the flexibility in your schedule that when something kind of catches your attention, perhaps unexpectedly, you can follow up on it right away and see if it leads somewhere. Right? And this is sort of paradoxical for a lot of people here, especially students. But in essence, you have to do less that is formal, right? You have to do less to get more. You have to let your schedule have lots of free, unstructured free time in it. And you have to have a bias towards exploration, right? Which is hard for people to think about because when you want to be impressive, you're like, I got to be doing things. I got to be signed up for things. I got to be, you know, putting in the structured work on it. But the research says that's not the way these things develop. It has to be, you have to just be exposing yourself to these all sorts of different things, talks, books, websites, see what catches your attention and have the freedom to follow up on it. That's the way this develops. I mean, that's your story, basically, right? I mean, if you go all the way back to the beginning of your story, it was a sort of interest in computer game development. But you're like, well, you had the free time in your schedule to sort of follow up on that, and that led you to Publina, which led you into blogging and other sorts of things. But you're a perfect case study for why you don't sit there and navel gaze, and you certainly don't fill your schedule with all sorts of structure and activities and hard work. You open your time, and you use the time to expose yourself to things, all sorts of things, and give yourself the freedom to follow up and see what comes out. Because we just know, it's decades of research, mountains of anecdotes, that's where these things come from, you know, not a Myers-Briggs test or walk by the beach.
Definitely, and I think that you bring up when you're talking about this point, I think it really is counterintuitive to most students, because if you look around and you think of, like, what's the strategy that people use to do well in school, to do well on their resumes if they're getting jobs or on their college applications if they're going to college or graduate school, and if you look around people, what do? They fill up their time with extracurriculars. They need to be captain of the football team. They need to have volunteer hours at the homeless shelter. They need to do all these other things. So when they have this resume, it's this bulleted list of all their accomplishments. And I think it's very unsettling for people, particularly the type A ambitious driven people, which I'm assuming is pretty much like us and pretty much like many of the readers here. You know, there's a lot of slackers, but the people who are really driven and they really have ambitions in life, and this idea that, you know what, that is wrong, and not only wrong, it's actually potentially harmful, because creating this bulleted list of mediocre accomplishments makes you look less impressive, and that the way to cultivate a passion, the way to cultivate these failed simulation effect, really deep successes in an area, is by having lots of free time, by doing less things, by having time to just say, you know what, this sounds interesting, maybe I'll start doing this, and you just experiment with it until you are able to find this path that's unusual, that hasn't been walked on a lot. And the fact that it requires this almost opposite mentality is somewhat unusual.
Yeah, I have a sort of story after story in my books of students that just are doing very little, have all this free time, and yet are just so impressive. In fact, the tagline on the back of my book is "Do less, live more, get accepted," which it scares the hell out of people. But I'll give you one more example. There's a student I'll call Kate who was in high school and doing sort of typical, completely overloaded thing, not sleeping, huge AP schedule, 90 clubs, and just was like, you know what, enough is enough. She quit basically most of her clubs, and those she remained in really reduced her role. Reduced down her schedule, and in fact went so far as to set up an independent study project where she would basically leave school at lunch each day.
and in the afternoon she was volunteering as a teacher's assistant over at a charter school. So her school day was done at noon, her class schedule was light, her extracurricular schedule was light, she was often done with her homework, you know, she could just finish it in the afternoon, she was no late night work sessions or whatever, just free time, just out there at this charter school, how can I be helpful? And over time, she began to get to know the culture and notice interesting opportunities, and she ended up organizing for them the study skills program where they brought students over from her private high school to this charter school to help tutor the kids. And then over more time, she got interested in their pedagogy, the theory behind their pedagogy, and went out and interviewed teachers at charter schools all over the East Coast and discovered some new method for teaching reading that some teacher in Brooklyn had discovered and brought that back. And so at the charter school, they changed the way they taught reading. So by the time she applied to Princeton, you know, not only she got in, but the interviewers were like, we were just so happy to see someone who's actually sort of in the real world and actually doing interesting things, not just in the Model UN Club or whatever. But again, this is a perfect point that she couldn't have done this. She hadn't have gone to the schedule where she basically had all day just kind of free at this charter school, sort of absorbing the culture, thinking about things, being exposed to opportunities. And that's the template, you know. That's the template for really interesting, impressive, unusual accomplishments. It's exactly that. You kind of need your own metaphorical equivalent of the independent study project that gives you half a day free.
Well, and I think really what this ties back to a lot of my recent article where I was talking about how discipline doesn't work in these elite pursuits. And I think it's sort of a classic case of being the best in the class versus being best in the world. And I know this from being in a high school setting in the past where to be the best in your class, a lot of that just comes down to working hard enough, because most of the people you're competing with are not working very hard. And I don't know about, it could depend on the high school if you're in an elite private high school where everybody's insane about their exams, but if you're just in a regular high school and it's not too big, being the best or being in the top few of your class is mostly just about making sure you work very hard, because a lot of the people are just going to barely graduate, they're going to skip class, they're not going to try very hard, or they're going to study but they're not going to really put in that much effort. And so a lot of high school students who are used to this atmosphere get in their head that the key to success is discipline and hard work. And it's very difficult to refute that, because it's true. It's definitely true. You need to be able to work hard. You need to have discipline. And particularly, as you said, the important kind of discipline to not fill your life with distractions, but to focus on what matters. But that kind of discipline is important. But once you go to this world-class setting where you're no longer competing with this small pool of sort of half-motivated applicants, you're competing against other people who are exactly like you. They have talent, they have intelligence, they have drive, they have ambition, they're willing to work really, really hard. And when you get into this situation where you're just one of 100 people who are all working their ass off, then you really can't take the same approach. And you talk about this book, just all these different mechanisms we're talking about, this failed simulation effect, this freeing up your schedule to pursue interesting activities, to the superstar effect. All of these different effects are about, well, when you're in that setting, when you're in this highly competitive setting where discipline is no longer the decisive factor but just a prerequisite, how do you operate? How do you operate to still be successful? And you give a lot of interesting ideas there.
Yeah, and I think it's worth adding to this notion that, you know, every student I interviewed for my book, for example, was happy. And I think this is sort of the twist on it, is that when you're pursuing sort of impressiveness on your own terms, this sort of, you've stumbled into something that you've developed a passion for and there's not a defined competitive structure, and you're able to keep your attention sort of focused on that and bring it to interesting places, that's an interesting life to live, it's very engaging, the time demands are reasonable, and you have a lot of autonomy. So it has all the ingredients of being a lifestyle that's actually engaging to live. And I want to throw that in there. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why I went back in time to write a book for high school students, even though I've been advancing through my own life, is that I figure if you can implant this idea at the young age that you can have sort of interestingness and success in your life on your own terms, you plant that idea at a young age, then they're going to go forward with that idea in college and do their first job.
Whereas if you do the opposite, if you do this sort of, well, suffer now to get into some good school, because that'll, then in the future I'll be happy once I have the good job or once I have the good school. If you take that mindset like instead, that's going to stick. Right? And you're going to end up in college, well, I'll kill myself in college, I'll get a good job, and you get a job and say, well, I'll really sort of kill myself in the standard competitive structures here so that I can become higher up in the job. And you end up getting to retirement, you'll never actually be happy with what you're doing. So I think that's an important angle on it, that a lot of this is planting the idea that it's worth stepping back and saying, what do I want broadly in my life? What do I want it to be like? And how can I actually get that?
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you for being here for the conversation and to let everyone know to buy your book. Is there anything else that you'd like to add just as a final point about the book or about your blog?
Just say, thanks for having this chat, Scott, and I think our audiences at this point are more or less one and the same, but I'll just say if you're a Scott Young reader, then yeah, definitely tell Newport.com if you want to find out about this, and if you're a Study Hacks reader who found this, then if you're not reading Scott Young, you should be.
Well, thanks, Tom.